Hi, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds. Today's front page stories are called County Provides More Plague Info, Realignment Reaches Finish Line, CARE Launches Role of Downtown Ambassador, and a backcountry alert system for Grand Canyon. So those are our front page stories, and I'm going to begin with the one at the top, which is called Coconino County Shares Public Health Information on Plague. Investigation into Prairie Dog Die-Off Finds Plague Was Not Present. And this is written by Abigail Kessler, Sun Staff Reporter. County health officials have published additional information about plague surveillance and the disease in prairie dog populations online after a person died of an unrelated case of plague in Flagstaff earlier this month. Coconino County Health and Human Services, CCHHS, is reporting a low risk to the public from the disease, and said a finished investigation into the prairie dog die-off, reported the same week, found no presence of the plague. The two incidents are not related, according to CCHHS. After sending a statement confirming a patient in Flagstaff Medical Center's emergency department recently died of plague, Northern Arizona Healthcare has declined to provide additional details, citing patient privacy under HIPAA. CCHHS is also declining interview requests on the topic, instead providing written answers and directing people to its Frequently Asked Questions, FAQ, website on the plague. The County Health Department now has a page providing details about the disease, including symptoms, prevention, how the county tracks endemic diseases, and what to do about suspected infections in humans or animals. It can be found at coconino.az.gov/3465/plague. According to this CCHHS website, the source of the exposure is still under investigation for the recent death. Some possibilities have been ruled out, including that it could be associated with the prairie dog die-off reported in the Townsend-Winona area July 7th. It said the investigation of the die-off has concluded and found that plague was not present in the colony. When asked what had caused the die-off, CCHHS said not all changes in prairie dog behaviors are the result of a die-off, including this case. Prairie dogs are highly social and attuned to their environment, it said. During the hotter times of the year, prairie dogs spend more time in their burrows than on the surface. They also may vacate areas temporarily due to an increase in predators, and in some cases, they leave to visit neighboring colonies where there are different or more resources. It explained that the term die-off refers to a lack of prairie dog activity in an area that includes multiple properties. The species is very susceptible to plague, so the presence of the disease will decimate the whole colony and neighboring colonies. When a die-off has occurred, according to the statement, no prairie dogs will be visible, even in nearby areas. When the die-off reported last week was investigated, prairie dogs were visible to the CCHHS animal service officer surveying the property, the health department said. CCHHS continues to encourage residents to contact us if they suspect a die-off, which means there is no activity in the area, CCHHS wrote. The occasional dead prairie dog is not an indicator of a die-off. However, if there is no activity in and out of any burrows and or dead prairie dogs across the landscape, this may be an indicator of a plague-induced die-off. Please note, prairie dogs do not necessarily die on the exterior of their burrows and may not be visible. The risk to the public from plague remains low, according to the website, which noted that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, reports an average of 7 plague cases in the United States each year. The most recent known case of human-to-human transmission was in 1924. CCHHS conducts surveillance for plague and other endemic diseases. Its communicable disease and epidemiology teams investigate reports of a suspected case of illness to determine the source and potential spread. This begins with contact tracing to find the source of the illness and who else might have been exposed. Plague and other zoonotic diseases, examples endemic to Coconino County include hantavirus, rabies, and West Nile virus, are generally not transmissible from a person to a person, but rather from a vector like mosquitoes, fleas, animals carrying rabies, or rodent droppings to a human host. CCHHS's Medical Examiner's Office works with the Bureau of State Laboratory Services, State Lab, from the Arizona Department of Health Services, ADHS, to conduct testing during an investigation of deaths with uncertain or unknown causes. The county department received test results on Friday, July 11th, confirming that the individual died from pneumonic plague, referring to a lung infection which can be spread through respiratory droplets. Diagnosing and confirming infectious disease is a multi-step process that uses different types of testing, CCHHS wrote in response to questions. Confirmatory tests are essential to verify the results of initial tests, especially when a definitive diagnosis is needed to guide treatment or public health interventions. Pending confirmatory test results, public health begins several essential activities to control the spread of potential disease and gather information. These include case identification and investigation, contact tracing, implementing interim control measures, and dissemination of appropriate prevention information. CCHHS conducted contact tracing to identify individuals who had contact with the decedent, and public health measures were implemented. When there is a prairie dog die-off, the department will survey the property and perform appropriate flea mitigation. It does not have plans to relocate prairie dogs, as they are native to the area and are considered a keystone species with a valuable role in the ecosystem. The website says active prairie dog colonies and associated fleas are not harmful, but that a sudden die-off can indicate the disease's presence. The animals tend to die quickly once they are infected, which is why they are an indicator for plague. The presence of prairie dogs indicates that there is not plague in the area, according to the website, which adds that fleas of active colonies do not need to be tested. When the colony suddenly goes dormant and no prairie dogs are seen in a previously active colony, CCHHS will first confirm a prairie dog die-off has occurred and then test fleas from vacant burrows from plague. CCHHS asks those noticing a sudden die-off of rodents or rabbits to contact Animal Services 928-679-8756 or Environmental Health 928-679-8760 to report. It advised residents concerned about the health of their animals, such as cats, dogs, or livestock, to contact their veterinarian, as plague has different symptoms for different species. More about plague in Coconino County, including human symptoms and recommended prevention, is available at coconino.az.gov/3465/plague. Reports of other zoonotic diseases. CCHHS also confirmed on Tuesday afternoon a case of hantavirus and an incident of rabies exposure in Coconino County. Both took place near the Grand Canyon. A person working at Grand Canyon National Park tested positive for hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, according to a statement sent by CCHHS, and is recovering. Hantavirus is spread primarily through contact with infected rodents, primarily deer mice, through contact with their urine, droppings, and saliva. When fresh urine, droppings, or nesting materials of an infected rodent are stirred up, the virus can get into the air. Prevention measures listed on the CDC's website for hantavirus primarily include avoiding contact with these materials, rodent control, and safety and safely cleaning up if mice or rats are found in a home. Instructions for safely cleaning after rodents are at cdc.gov/healthy-pets/rodent-control/clean-up.html. Hantavirus cannot be spread between people and does not have a specific cure or treatment, though CCHHS added that early medical attention can increase the chance of survival. A different individual was exposed to rabies during a river rafting trip in the Grand Canyon and recovered after receiving post-exposure prophylaxis treatment, according to CCHHS. Rabies spreads through the bite of an infected animal. The exposure in this case came from a bat. The bat was collected along the Colorado River near Kanab Creek Canyon and tested positive for rabies, according to CCHHS. Rabies prevention measures listed in a CCHHS fact sheet include avoiding wild animals for both humans and pets, keeping dogs on a leash of no more than 6 feet, vaccinating pets against rabies, and reporting any animals that are behaving strangely. These reports can be made to the City of Flagstaff Animal Control at 928-774-1414 or CCHHS Animal Services 928-679-8756 for county residents living outside a city or town. CDC information about hantavirus and rabies can be found at cdc.gov/hantavirus and cdc.gov/rabies. More on public health in Coconino County is at coconino.az.gov/2124/health-and-human-services. And that article was called Coconino County Shares Public Health Information on Plague. Investigation into prairie dog die-off finds plague was not present. And that was written by Abigail Kessler, Sun staff reporter. Next on our front page, we have an article titled, City of Flagstaff Celebrates Completion of Decades-Long Beulah University Realignment by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. It only took 25 years. Flagstaff's Beulah University Realignment Project, initially conceived at the turn of the millennium as a fix for the city's traffic congestion woes, is complete. And as a Flagstaff resident, yay! It's about time. The city hosted a ribbon-cutting ceremony on Tuesday, June 15th, to celebrate the full opening of the University Avenue extension. The roundabout where University now meets Beulah Boulevard, and the pedestrian underpass beneath Milton Road. I can tell you, yesterday I received an email from someone who said, when is it going to be open? It's been 5 years, Flagstaff Mayor Becky Daggett said at the ceremony. And we were able to say, tomorrow. It's going to be open tomorrow. Voters here originally approved the sale of transportation bonds to fund the realignment project, among other local improvements, in a May 2000 election. But it wasn't until 2013 that the city established a public-private partnership with the Arizona Department of Transportation, ADOT, and development firm Vintage Partners, to make the project possible. Let's see. Eagle Mountain Construction, the city's contractor for the project, broke ground in the spring of 2023. This project is a perfect example of what can be achieved through the public-private partnership model, Daggett said in her remarks. These partnerships bring together the strengths of both government and private industry to achieve results that neither could accomplish alone. And they're super easy to put together, right? So easy, Walter Crutchfield of Vintage responded. Crutchfield, speaking after Daggett, told the crowd of city employees, construction workers, and media, a day like today does not happen without massive perseverance. In order to get it to happen, you had to come up with a way that a state agency could transact with a local municipality, and somehow a private enterprise could do it in a way that profit was generated, he continued. The profit generated part sailed a long time ago. But the awesome thing is that days like these still happen. He added, we kept our word. Through the tripartite agreement, Vintage relocated Harkins Theater to a new building by the Flagstaff Mall, moved ADOT's Flagstaff facility into the old Harkins building off of Woodlands Village Boulevard to make room for the university extension, and acquired the rights to develop the parcel of land now nestled between Milton, Beulah, and the new roundabout. That development, known as Milltown, remains in the planning stage. We still have work ahead of us, Crutchfield said, alluding to the unfinished development. and I hope what's eventually here will be beautiful and amazing. Speaking with the Arizona Daily Sun afterward, Crutchfield said the opening of the new pedestrian and bicycle underpass was a relief after all the years of planning, preparation, and construction. And I'm ecstatic that the city, the state, and Vintage hung together for the 12 years that it took to get to this day, he added. Despite the alignment project's long history, the actual construction wrapped up ahead of schedule, 4 months earlier than planned, according to Eagle Mountain owner Marco Spagnuolo. He credited the early finish to collaboration between all of the partners involved in the project, from the city to the state to utility providers. We all came together during the design phase to work out a bunch of potential issues, Spagnuolo explained. And when we're brought in as a CMAR, Construction Manager at Risk contractor, before the job starts to work with the engineers during the design phase, we really get to provide input that helps save time and money. The total price of the project topped $22 million. The majority of the funding came from the city, but Vintage Partners provided $1.6 million to construct the new pedestrian underpass. Speaking inside the underpass, after the ribbon cutting, City Council member Kara House said, "I love getting glimpses of people walking through this already." Through the event, there was a steady trickle of passers-by utilizing the tunnel. "I walked through to get to this event and heard people saying how fun it was just to walk through this tunnel," House continued. "We had different visions of what this would look like, but to see it coming to completion and fruition is definitely a good thing." Vice Mayor Miranda Sweet said the new underpass felt like a natural fit for its location. "I can't remember what it looked like before this now. You know what I mean? It just seems like it's been here," Sweet said. David Peterson, the city's project manager, has been working on the realignment and the underpass for 7 years. "I never would have believed it'd be possible to lay a tunnel across the busiest road in town," Peterson said. "So thank you to the group for, I don't want to say accomplishing the impossible, but something that is very challenging." Spagnuolo said traffic control was without a doubt the most difficult part of construction. Milton is one of the most heavily trafficked streets in Flagstaff, serving as both a major commercial corridor and a primary access point to Interstates I-17 and 40, and maintaining some flow of vehicles was a constant challenge. "My superintendent, who constructed this job from day one, he's so excited about going to a job where he doesn't have to have traffic control," Spagnuolo said, chuckling. "So we're trying to say, okay, what work in the woods do we have for Dan for the next job?" Daggett thanked the numerous people and organizations who contributed to the project, including Northern Arizona University, Metro Plan, Mountain Line, all the local businesses that put up with the chaos that was out there, city staff, and the construction crews. To the public, she said, "Thank you for your patience." Only Milltown left to go. And what of Milltown, the long-awaited final piece of the public-private partnership puzzle. Earlier this year, Vintage received the Flagstaff City Council's approval after two discussions and a 5-2 vote to submit a new site plan for the mixed-use residential and commercial development. The city's previous plans had drawn some criticism, primarily targeting the building's height and its focus on rent-by-the-room student housing. Full details of the revised plan have not yet been made public, but Crutchfield said on Tuesday, "I think people will be encouraged. There's a massive gain in one bedrooms and a huge deletion of the big 4-5 bedrooms, which I think is what people were asking for." He added, "We're excited about the potential retail partners. We've tracked the one retail partner, a grocery store who will remain nameless, for the last 7 years. Everybody kept saying, they're going here or they're going here. They've always wanted to be here." He indicated the future Milltown site across the street. "So it was always just, could we do it in a timely fashion when it fit their schedule?" Crutchfield has previously named Trader Joe's as one of the Milltown's possible commercial tenants. Ooh. Crutchfield said he still believes Milltown will be a successful example of integrating housing development with multimodal transportation accessibility, a pedestrian crossing with bike lanes, connections to the FUTS, Flagstaff Urban Trail System, trail, and bus-only lanes. The new site plan should be made public within the next 1 to 2 months, he said. And let's get back to the beginning of the article. So I can tell you that this article was called City of Flagstaff Celebrates Completion of Decades-Long Beulah University Realignment. And that was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. And just a brief reminder that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona's programming is primarily designed for and directed to people who cannot read conventional print due to a disability. You can listen to various streams of Sun Sounds at sunsounds.org. Next on the front page, we have an article that is titled, CARE Launches Role of Downtown Ambassador by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. Flagstaff's CARE unit added a new role last week, a downtown ambassador, who is intended to serve as an extension of the program's alternative response model. The ambassador will walk the downtown area between Sitgreaves Street on the west and W.C. Riles Street on the east, and from Cherry Avenue on the north to Butler Avenue on the south, to offer connections to social services, non-emergency behavioral health, and substance use response, and directions or assistance for visitors. Flagstaff's downtown is both a popular tourist destination and a congregating place for homeless, unsheltered, or transient individuals. Public intoxication in the area and the behaviors that tend to follow from it have long been a concern for business owners and the city. We definitely see the social issue. We have an unsheltered population that struggles with substance use, and we want to provide additional support for that, Terros Health Regional Manager Thea Sherman said. Terros operates the CARE unit under contract with the city. Taros is still in the process of hiring someone for the ambassador position after a previous candidate backed out. For the moment, existing Taros staff will fill the role on an interim basis, likely 1 to 2 days a week. But within a month or two, the downtown ambassador should be active Wednesday through Saturday each week from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. The downtown ambassador will receive training specific to mental and behavioral health, she said. They will work proactively on outreach to downtown businesses, speaking to owners and employees about the care unit and other resources available for individuals who are intoxicated or in crisis. When Sherman and other leaders of the care unit mentioned the ambassador program during their presentation to the Flagstaff City Council on July 1st, Vice Mayor Miranda Sweet was enthusiastic about the initiative. "I'm a small business owner. I have been in downtown for 25 years," Sweet said the following week. In addition to serving on the council, Sweet owns and operates Rainbow's End, a clothing boutique. "I'm seeing a need for some extra services in the downtown." She's grateful, she said, that the city continues to seek positive solutions for the area's challenges. "I'm excited, even if it starts with a slow roll," Sweet said. She also hopes that, like the CARE program, the ambassador will help reduce the volume of non-emergency calls for Flagstaff's other first responders. "There will be crossover," Sweet acknowledged, "but I'm hoping this will relieve some of the calls going into our police and fire departments." Part of the CARE unit's mission has always been to provide an unarmed and unintimidating response to situations not requiring a law enforcement presence. According to Sherman, her team has a strong relationship with the Flagstaff Police Department and a mutual understanding of where police resources are best directed. "There has been a bit of a culture shift, especially with the new police chief coming," Sherman said. "They really want to collaborate on these issues and provide support." The downtown ambassador will be present at events in Heritage Square or Wheeler Park when scheduling allows, and serve as a general resource for visitors. "Depending on who they're bumping into, I think there will be a lot of questions from tourists on how do I get to point A or point B," Sweet predicted. She expects the ambassador will also be fielding questions about restaurants, restrooms, bus passes, shelter services, warm meals, and safe places to sleep. "I think the list goes on," she added. "And I know that we are tackling that a lot with the care unit. We're really trying to throw a lot of specialists into this all throughout Flagstaff." Additionally, Sherman said the ambassador will provide railroad safety information and help keep an eye on the downtown track crossings. 4 individuals have been fatally struck by trains in Flagstaff in 2025, but none of those deaths occurred within the ambassador's planned area of service. As the program gets rolling, look for individuals wearing Taros Health t-shirts around town. Sherman and clinical supervisor Danielle Simmons were scheduled to take the first shift on July 10th. "The downtown area is a beautiful place to be," Sherman said. We just want to make it a safe and enjoyable place for everybody. And that article was called Care Launches Role of Downtown Ambassador, and that was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. And we will finish up the front page with this article called A Backcountry Alert System for Grand Canyon. This is also written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. Monsoon season in northern Arizona can be a welcome respite from early summer heat. But the intense thunderstorms can also produce flash flooding, sending water and debris coursing rapidly down previously tranquil drainages. Now an alert system utilizing satellite communications can help provide warnings of flash flood events in a place previously beyond the reach of emergency notifications, the Grand Canyon. The beaches down there are great places to camp, said Tim Carter, Coconino County's acting emergency management director, until it's time for a flash flood. The Grand Canyon River Alert System is a collaborative project of Coconino County Emergency Management, the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, the National Weather Service, NWS, and the National Park Service, NPS. It provides text alerts to satellite messaging devices, like those sold by Garmin, Spot, and other brands, about imminent flash flood risk at tributary drainages along the Colorado River, as well as other potential hazards. The Grand Canyon is often a place people go to disconnect, Carter acknowledges. But some canyon travelers, particularly commercial guides, are already carrying satellite communicators on their trips. We understand there's people that go down on the Colorado River for a three-week rafting trip and want no communications with the outside world. And I'm really jealous of that, Carter said. We understand that, and the alert is not intended to replace common sense and things like that. We want to give just one more awareness tool, one more way to receive information if you need it. Tom Gushu, Geographic Information Systems Coordinator for the USGS's Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center in Flagstaff, said, "The biggest thing is it's a new form of communication that we didn't have before. This gives people receiving the alerts an extra piece of information that they can add to their on-the-ground observations, as well as their decision-making process when they're in the backcountry," Gushu said. The new system received a quiet rollout last spring, and last summer was considered a test phase. Over the 2024 river season, 29 alerts were issued, primarily for flash flooding events, although Gushu noted that there was at least one alert warning river runners of a raft stuck on a rock. Now, as the 2025 monsoon season begins, the agencies behind the system are making a broader push to publicize its availability. To sign up, users must text GC River Alerts to 928-707-7842 from the device on which they wish to receive alerts. A confirmation message will indicate successful enrollment on the list. Users can also unsubscribe or stop messages at any time. I'd say it's important to do this. Let's say you're going on a river trip. Before you get to Lee's Ferry, Hushu said. Make sure the day before you're going to launch, go ahead and subscribe your device and test it out. Charge the batteries, he added. Anyone interested can also subscribe to the alerts from a regular cell phone or email address and receive them wherever they have connection. Carter noted that some support staff of guiding companies have done that in order to stay informed about conditions that might affect their clients. The flood alerts are based on a combination of NWS's weather radar and forecasting abilities with USGS's existing data sets, identifying river miles, popular campsites, and the river's tributaries. The information that the USGS provided helped us just pinpoint what areas are most conducive to flash flooding and debris flows in the Grand Canyon, said Brian Klimowski, head of the regional NWS office in Belmont. When the office's radar shows sufficiently heavy or intense rain over or near the canyon, forecasting staff can correlate rainfall with the drainages most likely to be impacted, along with the specific river mile locations along the Colorado. They'll forward that information to Coconino County Emergency Management and follow up with a phone call. Usually from the time that they call us to the time that the message has been disseminated through the system, it's less than 5 minutes, Carter said. Although this new satellite messaging alert system is the first of its kind in the U.S., all parties involved agreed that there were relatively few major challenges to getting it up and running. Being a county of this size, we have the unfortunate reality of having a lot of experience in sending emergency alerts out, Carter said. Our staff is well versed and trained on that. We have the system, the infrastructure in place. Adding one more type of alert to the NWS repertoire was not much of a lift, Klimowski said. It was all a matter of getting the right people in the same room and all talking about the hazards, gaps, and solutions. The hurdles were mostly minor, such as simplifying or shortening messages to ensure that all satellite messengers could receive them. The messages need to be in plain text, Carter explained, because many of those devices only have the texting capabilities of your 1995 Nokia cell phones. Gushu noted that the project received initial funding from USGS's Natural Hazards Mission Area. The Grand Canyon Research and Monitoring Area is part of the Ecosystems Mission Area, a different division within the agency. It's not something we normally do, he said, but they've been really helpful, and they gave us the seed funding to go forward and talk about risk and communication around these events. He also thanked the National Park Service for its cooperation. NPS rangers and staff helped guide the creation of the messaging for the alerts and will be responsible for initiating any alerts about non-weather hazards or missing persons. Over the weekend, the system was used to warn boaters about the impact of the Dragon Bravo fire. They have a lot on their plate, and this was something that they allowed us to run with, Gushu said. We work in their jurisdiction, and they've been very supportive. Grand Canyon River Guides, the professional association, also provided important early input and feedback helping shape the development of the alert system. In addition to urgent information about floods and hazards, the alerts can warn boaters about unanticipated changes in Glen Canyon Dam water releases, which can lead to critically low or high water levels at rapids. Now that the system has been operational for a year, Carter said he's speaking to emergency management staff in Mojave County about the possibility of issuing similar alerts for the lower stretches of the Colorado River. That would require the cooperation of the Las Vegas NWS office, but Coconino County has proven the system can work smoothly. This type of system has very wide applicability, Klimowski said. Sending weather warnings to satellite messaging devices can be done in other places besides the Grand Canyon. Of course, you can think of many remote areas where such a system can be very, very useful. Additional details about how to sign up for alerts are available at nps.gov/GRCA/plan-your-visit/Colorado-river-emergency-alerts. More data sought from public. USGS has also launched a new survey to gather additional data about flash floods, debris flows, and similar incidents in the Grand Canyon. The survey is available through a web browser or through the ArcGIS Survey 123 mobile application, and it allows respondents to report the date, time, location, and effects of a rain-induced event and submit photos if available. Both the web and mobile application versions can be accessed by scanning the attached QR code. Our partners at the National Weather Service identified this as a primary need for improving their forecasts in the challenging terrain of the Grand Canyon, Gushue said. Klimowski confirmed that any information we can have regarding the history of flooding, history of debris flows in an area helps our ability to forecast and to anticipate flash floods, he said. And that article was called A Backcountry Alert System for Grand Canyon, and it was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun Staff reporter. Now we're going to move along to the Arizona and local page where we have two obituaries, sadly, to read. The first is for Lieutenant Colonel Samantha Ann Holies. It is with great sadness that we announce the passing of our beloved Samantha. Samantha was born on 2/19/1981 to Larry and Becky Holies in Barstow, California. She is survived by her husband, John Muff, mother Becky Holies, sisters Sandra Jackowicz, Stacy Duncan, and numerous nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, and many friends, both military and civilian. Samantha was an avid swimmer and competed on her high school and college teams, earning numerous trophies. After graduation from high school, Samantha went on to graduate from the University of Arizona in Tucson, where she earned a degree in political science. Then she chose a military career in the Army, where she served her country both in the U.S. and overseas, earning the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. She loved to cook for her family and friends. She is preceded in death by her father, Larry Holies, grandparents Sid and Frances Hodges, and Frank and Lolita Holies. Donations can be made to the Army Emergency Fund, AER, in Samantha's name. Memorial service will be held on July 22, 2025 at 9 a.m. at Falconer Funeral Home on Juniper Avenue, Gilbert, Arizona. Our other obituary today is for Victoria Ann Reyes, Miss Vicky, who was born to Bernardino and Asuncion Reyes in Cottonwood, Arizona. Victoria was a loving mother, devoted grandmother, and talented cook who touched the lives of everyone who knew her. Victoria grew up in Flagstaff, where she attended Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Elementary School, St. Michael Indian School, and Flagstaff High School, graduating in 1971. After marrying, she moved to Page, Arizona, where she raised four wonderful children. Throughout her life, she was known for her boundless love, fierce determination, and warm-hearted spirit. Vicky mastered her cooking skills through a deep, genuine love that she shared through her food. Cooking in nutrition for the school districts of Arizona and Utah, Banner Hospital, short order meals at local bars, dives, or family gatherings. Her kitchen was a place where love was served alongside every dish. Beyond the kitchen, Vicky had a passion for collecting Betty Boop figurines and crocheting with her sisters, creating handmade treasures. She also cherished summer days, making memories at Lake Powell with her grandchildren, and attending the annual Balloon Regatta air shows, a tradition that always brought her joy. Vicky's love for her family was immeasurable, and she will be deeply missed by her children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, siblings, and all who were fortunate to know her. Her legacy of kindness, love, and devotion will live on in the hearts of her family and friends forever. She is survived by her children, Tomas Lozano, Tammy Lozano, Marcos Lozano with Chris, and Matthew Lozano with Paula. Seven grandchildren, three great-grandchildren, sisters Rosie Gallegos with Daniel, Cecil Navarro, Christy Carrillo with Fabian, Nina Chavez, Terry Quinlan, and many other loved ones. She was preceded in death by her parents and her brothers, Ramon, Ralph, Bobby, and Richard. Now it looks like we've got a news brief for two local stories, so we'll read those. The first one's called Sheriff's Deputies Seize Marijuana Guns in I-40 Stop Near Winona. The Coconino County Sheriff's Office, CCSO, canine unit, arrested two people and seized more than 20 pounds of marijuana following a traffic stop on Interstate 40 near Winona. The stop occurred around 5:30 a.m. on Tuesday, July 15th. Upon searching the vehicle, the deputy reportedly discovered two handguns and 22.68 pounds of marijuana. An image released by CCSO shows the alleged marijuana in vacuum-sealed black plastic packaging. The driver of the vehicle was Jatavian Cozy Carroll, and the passenger was Jamel Ezekiel Busby. Both were booked on charges of transporting drugs for sale, possession of a weapon in the commission of a drug offense, and failure to accurately answer an officer when asked about concealed weapons. Carroll was also charged with carrying a concealed weapon without a permit. Although recreational marijuana use is legal for Arizona adults, transportation of large amounts of marijuana by anyone other than the agent of a licensed marijuana establishment remains a crime. Transporting more than 2 pounds of marijuana for the purpose of sale is a Class 2 felony. Carroll and Busby were each held on a $30,000 cash or secured bond. As of Wednesday morning, they remained in custody at the Coconino County Detention Facility. And that brief was called Sheriff's Deputies Seize Marijuana Guns in I-40 Stop Near Winona. Our other news brief is called Man Sentenced for Machete Incident That Prompted School Lockdown. This one's written by Sam McLaughlin. A man who threatened two people with a machete in Flagstaff earlier this year received a 5-year prison sentence in Coconino County Superior Court on Monday. Robert Efrain Contreras, 36, was arrested on January 16th by the Flagstaff Police Department with assistance from the local interagency SWAT team. Contreras had approached two people in a vehicle outside his residence on East Miller Drive, yelling and holding a 2-foot machete and an 8-inch kitchen knife. Oh boy. Let's see. He then retreated to his apartment and refused to exit when police arrived. The standoff prompted a temporary lockdown at nearby Thomas Elementary School and was ultimately resolved without any injuries. Contreras' two sons, ages 12 and 14, were inside the apartment with him. One exited through a rear window with the assistance of police. Contreras eventually surrendered his machete to an officer, but would not agree to leave the building. The SWAT team finally broke down the door, finding Contreras seated in the kitchen with his son. He was charged with 2 counts of aggravated assault, a Class 3 felony, for placing the two people in the vehicle in reasonable apprehension of imminent physical injury. Contreras pleaded guilty to both counts, with one designated as dangerous and the other designated as non-dangerous. His plea agreement stipulated a 5-year prison term followed by probation. At the sentencing hearing, his son's grandmother spoke, alleging that Contreras used meth and was physically violent toward his children. Contreras' attorney, Daniel Hartman Strawn of the Public Defender's Office, noted in response that no charges of drug use, drug possession, or domestic violence had been filed against his client. Hartman Strawn claimed that Contreras' actions, though misguided, were motivated by a desire to protect his children. Prosecuting attorney Sasha Charles, representing the Coconino County Attorney's Office, disagreed with that interpretation of events. And that was some news briefs for today. And that's all the time we have today for the Arizona Daily Sun. From Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Lisa Cantor Ganey. I'm your volunteer reader today, and I wish you a great rest of your day, and take care.